This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Award-winning author and illustrator John Rocco is perhaps best known for his cover art on the Percy Jackson and the Olympian series, along with other children's books. But about 20 years ago, Rocco worked at a company called Digital Domain doing special effects for a little film called Apollo 13, which he says sparked a deeper interest in the many complexities of how we get people into space. Today, Rocco has a new children's book called How We Got to the Moon. He wrote and meticulously illustrated each step of the space race and tells the stories of the 400,000 people behind this grand accomplishment, from geologists to seamstresses, welders, and engineers. One of those engineers featured in the book is Joanne Morgan, the only woman in the Launch Control Center when Apollo 11 lifted off. She had a career that spanned more than 45 years at NASA and is still involved in encouraging other women to get involved in STEM. Both Rocco and Morgan join me now, and Rocco starts by explaining what his book can give to young readers that's been missing in other accounts of the Apollo missions.
Well, I had looked at a lot of different books about the Apollo program for young people, and most of them tend to focus on the astronauts and their mission. And I didn't see much about everything that went on before that happened, what led to it, what was the buildup. And so for me, it was about the people on the ground who made the machines that actually supported this mission. And I wanted to structure it in a way where you got some of the history as to why we were actually going to the moon, but also you would slowly uncover the science behind it all. And if you break it down, everything we did, you know, can be boiled down to these really simple scientific ideas, whether it be Newton's laws or thermodynamics or orbital mechanics, and so they build upon each other.
Yeah, this book is kind of an art, physics, history, and science book all in one. And you mentioned you kind of go over some basic physics laws. There's photographs you recreate, drawings, blueprints, and so much more. And what's all the more impressive is that you illustrated everything from scratch. So why did you want to do that?
I think for me, the biggest reason was because as you go through all these documents and blueprints and everything that NASA has put out there in the world, it can be overwhelming. And especially when you put some of that stuff into a book, it loses a little bit of accessibility for our young readers, I think. Having it all drawn by one hand kind of creates a more accessible approach. And as I recreated some of these things in the book, I was able to really focus on the things that I needed to show to get the point across and remove all the extraneous stuff that just adds confusion.
As you mentioned, NASA has put out so much to the public of blueprints, photos, what was involved in the Apollo missions. So what was your research process like, and who did you get to speak with, and did you get to see any of these objects that you draw and recreate, like, up close and in person? Because I imagine there's just so many primary things to look at.
Yeah, it's interesting. I started off with, as probably everyone does who writes about the space program, with everything that's available online, and then also in a myriad of books. I have an entire bookshelf dedicated to Apollo. But, you know, there's a lot of things that I didn't understand, and I knew if I couldn't understand them, there's no way I could, you know, present that information to a young reader and have them understand it. So I started reaching out to the Apollo engineers themselves. You know, with 400,000 people that worked on this program, you can find someone who is still around, who worked on this part or this, you know, was a systems engineer for this aspect of the rocket. And so it started with a guy that I met named Donald Rethke. And he brought me to his house and to the museum where he was a docent. And within like 15 minutes, I was holding an actual Apollo spacesuit, which I probably shouldn't have. But when he said, yeah, you can unzip it and check it out, I was on board. And within a few minutes of arriving at his house, he had the entire table filled with all kinds of everything from space toilets to helmets and gloves. And so I was able to inspect a lot of different things. I traveled around the country to lots of different museums. And I think by the time I started the second draft of the book, I had about 24 Apollo engineers, including Joanne Morgan, answering my questions about any particular aspect of it. And through that process, I got to hear their personal stories, which, you know, a lot of them I hadn't read anywhere. And I've read a lot about the program. So when you meet these individual people who are not necessarily the Gene Kranz or the Kurt Debus or the people that are higher up and more familiar, you get these stories that no one's heard before. And that was fascinating.
Yeah, I love learning about the things us lay people don't think about when it comes to launching people into space. You know, you show everyone from the well-known seamstresses to geologists, and you show that it's not all the white men in the control room that we see all the pictures of. And you mentioned Joanne Morgan, and she's here with us on the line. And Joanne, you were the instrumentation controller for Apollo 11 and the only woman in the Launch Control Center when that launched. And you had lived in Florida as a teenager where you could see rockets launch pretty frequently. But what was it that sparked your interest in pursuing engineering and being in NASA?
Well, I had a natural inclination for math and science as a high school student, but I always thought I'd probably be a piano teacher because I was very musical too. And Explorer 1 was launched in 1958 in January, and the discovery of the Van Allen belt, and I got to see that launch. It was a night launch, not real visible because there was quite a few clouds that night, but still I got to see it. But I was most impressed by the discovery of the Van Allen belt and us understanding as a student, a senior in high school, that this new knowledge, nobody had ever known. Nobody on planet Earth had ever known this about our atmosphere. And what that meant to me was there is an incredible wealth of new knowledge that is going to come from these rockets going into space. And that door is opening, and I just wanted to get in on it. I thought this is going to change the world I live in. And as I reflect on it, my gosh, hasn't it in 50 years, 60 years? Because now we're so dependent on all of these things that are flying around the Earth in space, and understanding everything from navigation, communications, weather, Earth observing. I mean, we're very dependent on that new knowledge now that we're getting from space and all of the technology. So I was just a lucky kid in the right place at the right time with an inclination and had enjoyed math and science as a student. So I thought I'm going to become an engineer. I was only 17, and I hope if there are girls that are going to get a chance to read this book, that they really do some serious thinking about the fact that we need women in engineering. And I was just thrilled to be that lucky woman who was sitting in launch control and doing my job. I'd been there for 10 years, and that was my first launch to actually sit in the firing room at liftoff. I'd worked on launches, but I was excused a few hours before, and then a more senior person would take the position for the actual liftoff. But they asked me to be there, and I was just totally thrilled to death to be a part of making history.
Yeah, it's such an incredible moment. And your role on that day was instrumentation controller in the launch room for Apollo 11 liftoff. So can you explain what exactly that involves?
Well, the instrumentation controller was looking at a breadth of systems telemetry, tracking, data systems, the displays that were available coming from the computer that was reducing the guidance data from the vehicle as we were getting ready for liftoff, and then during the early phase of the mission while the engines were running. So that first 10 minutes after liftoff. And so it was a case of looking for and instrumentation on the ground too, including weather instrumentation. So it was a broad-based kind of role, but it was about communicating to the test supervisors and the top management team of the launch team if there were problems and how those problems were being worked and what our options were. Luckily, we had a wonderful countdown. I mean, we had almost a problem-free terminal countdown. So there was only one problem, a hydrogen leak, and that got worked. And the instrumentation that were detecting the leaks, everything was, you know, ticky-boo, as we would say. So it was a role of pretty broad-based systems knowledge that I had to have that I had acquired over a 10-year period of working there.
One of the things that you shared with me, Joanne, which I always come back to, is the fact that the reason you were placed in that chair was because you were the best communicator.
Yeah, my director, Carl Spindler, called me in to tell me that I was going to be there for liftoff. He said, You have such a good knowledge and your awareness of where a problem is and how it's being worked and what our options are. You communicate that so rapidly and so clearly. You're our best communicator, Joanne. So, and that went to even my writing in the logbook. He could read my writing, and I had good English and good punctuation, and you know, I was a good student in school. So And some engineers weren't so great at doing, writing in the logbook, and our logs would go off those. Everything was a lot of paper then. You know, we didn't have the computer technology that we depend on today. So you hand wrote things, and then they got typed up, and those records were kept, and they were carbon copies back then. So a little thing like a good solid skill of writing and speaking where people could understand you were important.
Most definitely. And John recreated the picture of you in the launch control center. What do you think about when you look at that shot? And what would you like people to keep in mind now, knowing what you know? And of course, it's your personal experience. What do you want people to see looking at a photo of the only woman in the room?
Well, that sometimes because you're the only person, in my case, being a female, and all the others were men, is that we are all able to do everything. Men, women, no matter what race, that the potential is in each human being. And I think that each human being should aspire to be as great as they can at what they love doing. In my case, I had a passion for knowledge. I love learning new things. And I got attracted to the launch industry because of that, and it's rewarded me. I never had a dull day at work. I learned something every day. And so I just encourage people to take away from me is to find that something you have a passion for and explore, and it will make you great in your own way. Each of us is able to do that.
One of the many things I learned from this book is about Randy Lovelace's Women in Space program that ran from 1960 to 1962, but unfortunately women wouldn't be accepted into the astronaut program for another 16 years. And Joanne, your career at NASA spanned over 45 years and includes top positions such as First Woman Division Chief, the First Woman Senior Executive at the Kennedy Space Center, the First Woman Associate Director for KSC. And I can't imagine this was easy or that all rooms were receptive and welcoming to having a woman in their ranks leading them. So can you touch upon some of your experiences working up through the ranks? And one thing that stuck out to me on a NASA article is that, you know, you don't ask engineers to make you coffee.
Oh, yeah, my that was my very first supervisor, Jim White. I mean, I hit the gold standard of supervisors. He insisted on an environment of mutual respect. I was there as an engineer trainee. I aspired to be an engineer, but I was going to be a young girl. I was only 17. That was a summer job. And so when he had his staff meeting and explained to all of those men, there was going to be a woman who was going to be working here. And the first thing somebody asked, oh, can we get her to make coffee? And he said, no, she's not the coffee girl. She is a student trainee engineer. She's to be treated just like you would treat any young man who comes in here who's a college student. And so he really set in place the rules. And because of that, I always felt safe. I was very shy, and it was hard for me to ask questions. And one time when we had a lightning strike, he sent me out to do a project to investigate what the equipment damage was at one of the tracking sites that was a trailer. And when I finished my report and gave it to him, he said, oh, this is excellent, because I listed out all the equipment, to talk to the technicians, how long it was going to take to repair, and then retest the whole system, and then bring the tracking system back up into operation. So I went to a big meeting with the experts that came down from Huntsville, Alabama, to the missile firing lab in Florida, and they were going to look at what all we had to do to get back on track for a schedule for one of the launches. And so I sat and listened, and they were talking about the timelines. And I came back to meeting with my supervisor. And so he said, well, what's the bottom line? I said, well, we're going to have a 4-day delay. And he said, but you were showing that we could have tracking back up in 2 days. And I said, well, I had turned my report in. He said, but did you speak up and tell people, wait a minute, we can be ready in 2 days. We don't have to have 4 whole days. That could have made a difference. And he chewed me out. I mean, he really chewed me out, because he wanted me to be an equal communicator in the team. So the importance of a supervisor who creates this environment of mutual respect and also gives you the supervision and kind of the coaching when and how you should be presenting the information when you're the one that knows it and has done the work. So, you know, I was very lucky in that respect. Now, I did have incidences. I mean, I had some things that were very distressing to me. I mean, sometimes I had to have some drawings signed, and I went to one of the senior engineers that had to sign the drawings, and I could hear him tell his secretary. She went in and said, we have this lady engineer here, she needs some drawings signed. He said, oh, tell that pipsqueak lady engineer I'm not going to sign her drawing. And so she sent me away. Then I had to call my director, and he had to take action. And he sent me elsewhere. So the man's boss actually signed the drawings. But and I'm sure that he was spoken to, but I luckily didn't have to go back and talk to him again. But, you know, over the years, there were lots of times. And the first time I went to work in the Launch Control Center at Blockhouse 34, this was before 2 years before Apollo 11, the test supervisor, when I walked in and sat down, he said, came over. He said, we don't have women working in here. So I called Carl Findler, who is my director, the man who did select me to be in the firing room at Apollo 11 liftoff. I called Mr. Findler and I said, the test supervisor says they don't allow women. He said, you sit down, plug in your headset, and go to work. I want test results by the end of this shift. And so I did what he said, and a little bit later in the day, Rocco Patron, who was one of the most senior people, came over and he said, Joanne, you're welcome. He'd seen me in meetings. I'd briefed him on different activities that I I needed to over a couple of years, and so he knew me. So, you know, from the top down, as well as my immediate supervisor, you know, the support that you get, all my mentors were men. I mean, my entire career, all of my mentors were men. But that's an important thing in the environment of work for equality of women.
What was your ultimate internal drive to be the one to create a path that other women could follow? Because you were the first woman in some of these spaces. And what kept you motivated and in turn leading and motivating others?
The main thing was observing bad decisions. When I saw, and I thought I wouldn't have decided that, you know, and as a junior engineer and then intermediate and becoming a senior engineer. And then when I saw some of the bad decisions that men were making, I thought I wouldn't have done that. We would go faster. We wouldn't have had an accident. We wouldn't have had something terrible happen. You know, if I'd been part of the decision process. And I think that is very key for the future of engineering, that women need to be a bigger part of decision processes, because women have a different survival instinct in some respects than men. I mean, because they produce children, it's the mama bear thing. You know, I'm out here in Montana, as you know, it's a very active bear season in the fall. So, and the mama bears are so protective of their cubs. But I think women carry some of that, and it's applied in different ways in our culture. So for me, when I saw bad decisions being made, I thought, that's what actually helped me become a division chief, was we had to make huge technology changes going from big mainframe computers to mini computers. This was in the 70s. And we had to have different ways of involving the user community of engineering in the software development instead of having a bunch of experts do all the software. So making that cultural change and that technology change together, also it allowed you to reduce the number of people doing some of the jobs. So downsizing a workforce. All those changes, I thought some of the decisions these men are making are terrible for the people. They're not going to embrace the mini computer technology. You know, we need to be doing some of these things differently. And so throughout my career, it was the opportunity to see that my decisions could be stronger and better for the goals that we were trying to achieve. And that carried me right through to the very last job that I had, which was not my favorite job, but it was something that needed to be done as director of external affairs and business development. Is at the Kennedy Space Center, we needed to embrace the new emerging commercial world, and that meant different deals, leasing out our NASA pads to people like SpaceX, and doing a lot of things differently. And because I could see that decisions needed to be coached into kind of a different way of thinking and preparing the center and the people that work there for a different future and a different relationship with the commercial industry. So, it's it's kind of crazy to explain, but as I reflect on it, from a historical perspective, the fact that I could make as good or better decisions than a lot of the men was really part of my inner motivation of taking a leadership position. I wasn't necessarily a natural leader. I wasn't the best technical engineer, but I was a good enough engineer across a number of variety of systems that I could be acceptable to the hardcore engineers as a leader, but it was the decisions about the people, the technology, the direction we needed to be taking, I think that, you know, helped my career progress.
Since you started going from spending 10 years at NASA before you even had a first launch to be included in the room to making executive decisions and leading, you know, do you think when you retired and left NASA, do you think that they are doing enough yet to inspire and promote STEM programs to bring in a more diverse workforce, to bring in more women and people of other races and backgrounds?
Well, I certainly think so when I look at Kennedy Space Center, because last summer, in fact, John, you were there at the Apollo 11 luncheon to honor the women of Apollo 11. The director, Bob Cabana, who was an astronaut and is still the director of the Kennedy Space Center, he was telling that something over 40% of his direct report senior executives now are women. And his associate director, a job I once held, is an African-American young man who actually had worked for me. I mentored him. So the work they're doing for STEM is just amazing. But, and also the NASA Alumni League, which I'm on their National Board of Directors, and they are very active in STEM activities. I think NASA probably overall reflects what I see at Kennedy Space Center. I don't know the exact data today, but I'm much more concerned now about our universities graduating enough women engineers and minority engineers, because, you know, we need that breadth involved in decision making. I think when you look at stuff like the Boeing airplane issues with the MAX and the auto industry, when the things don't work like airbags, that if women were involved in decision making in those organizations, that you wouldn't see some of that happening. So I'm just very, very much hopeful and wishing that universities would graduate a lot more women engineers and get them out there into the workforce. And companies needed to be hiring them. You know, there's less than 15% of the working engineers in this country are women. That's a terrible statistic. I mean, it was like less than 2% when I started out as a NASA young NASA engineer. It's a tough industry for women these days. And as one of the STEM factors, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, engineering is behind as far as opportunities exist for women. But somehow or another, they're not, even though a lot of universities graduate women engineers, they're not necessarily being embraced in the workplace. You know, like I was lucky enough to have a positive experience and was rewarded for it with promotion, but it's not that great in a lot of places today.
And it should be said, when Joanne invited me down to that luncheon down in Florida, it was no surprise that many of the women in the room got up to speak about how Joanne mentored them in their careers. She graciously deflects praise, but it was sort of awe-inspiring to see.
Well, and what do you both hope this book can do for young readers, young girls exploring its pages and learn more about the stories such as Joanne's and all of these other people who helped us get into space and helped us land on the moon?
Well, you know, I think that seeing faces that are like your own in a book sort of opens up that possibility, I think, for young readers. It was my intention to show people of color and the different sexes that were involved in doing this huge project. I hope to inspire problem solvers. And that's why I created this book. I wanted people to look at, you know, here's an impossible problem. We're going to go to the moon and we're going to do it in 9 years. It's this incredibly impossible problem. And all of these people got together and they worked together and they solved each little, you know, problem at a time, and they strung all those solutions together to figure out how to put a human being on another planet, which, you know, when we look back at that many years from now, it's going to be a big moment in history. And there were a lot of different interesting people involved. And so, you know, my hope is that kids will read this book and see all different possibilities for themselves in working on future problems.
And Joanne, what do you hope that young readers think about and learn about when they read about some of the work that you and many of your other colleagues were involved in the Apollo missions?
Well, one thing that I like about the book is the simplicity of the way John has broken it down so that almost any one little thing is simply explained where you can understand it. I mean, it's almost overwhelming to think about a project like going to the moon. It's so complex, and here these hundreds of thousands of people are involved. It's like, it's so overwhelming, but it actually is simple because it has to be broken down into these very simple little pieces, and then they're all put together like a giant, giant, giant puzzle, and then there's this beautiful picture, and you're landing on the moon. So if you for a child, a student, even a teacher looking at this, you can explain these pieces along the way, but an individual, a youngster, a boy or a girl can say, but I can be one of those pieces. I can know about a propulsion system, or I can know about a radar system, or, you know, I can be a part of this puzzle and be a part of history. And in a way, that's what inspired me as a young person. I didn't know what role I would play when I decided to become an engineer, but I wanted to be that one piece of that puzzle. And that can be anybody. Anybody can do this. And I hope it inspires some people to want to do it, because there are big, big, big projects ahead of us. I mean, this is certainly the biggest of my lifetime, and I think maybe the most important engineering accomplishment of the last 1,000 years, and maybe the next 1,000, who knows? I mean, I'm hoping I'm 80 years old. I hope I'll get to see us land on Mars and maybe a woman land on the moon, but maybe I won't get to see it. But, you know, these young people, they not only will see it, they can do it. They can choose to do it. And that's what I hope, is that some of them choose to do something great with their lives.
John, one last, kind of random question for you, but in such a massive book that you are meticulously drawing every aspect, what were some of the more challenging aspects of drawing either human, machine, space? What did you get stuck on?
Oh, well, some of them were really tricky. You know, drawing the interior of the vehicle assembly building was particularly challenging, mainly because it is like a living, breathing machine inside this huge cavernous space. And you have all of these different cranes and how they operate and move down transfer aisles and stack these gigantic rockets. So that was certainly one of the challenging things, is drawing these kind of cutaway sections of things that I didn't have physical access to. But again, there are lots of blueprints and lots of different things out there that helped tremendously. And I think trying to convey a certain aesthetic flowing from a painting of, you know, an F1 rocket engine being tested, to a diagram of an F1 rocket, to a portrait of the guy who managed all the people who designed the F1 rocket. So, you know, taking all of that different types of information and creating an aesthetic that you can easily flow from one to the other. was challenging, but I enjoyed it. I mean, I loved making this book. This was probably the coolest project I've ever worked on, and I've worked on some fun things. So, yeah, this is a high point for me.
Well, it's an amazing piece of work, and I want to thank you, John Rocco, and of course, Joanne Morgan, for joining us to talk about some of the work that was involved and your experiences. It was a great honor to speak with you.
Thank you, Andre. The honor was mine, ours. Thank you, Joanne.
You're welcome. Always fun talking to NPR.
John Rocco is an award-winning author and illustrator whose latest book is called How We Got to the Moon: The People, Technology, and Daring Feats of Science Behind Humanity's Greatest Adventure. He was joined by former NASA engineer Joanne Morgan. Both Rocco and Morgan, along with Anne Montgomery, the Apollo lead crew systems engineer, will hold a virtual event for Boswell Books this Friday evening.